Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
So we are here on the morning of the Wednesday after the election. I guess it's November 6th.
Yeah.
You know, had talked about doing the podcast a little later in the week while we were waiting to see they were counting votes or things came in late or Harris County got finished or whatever we were thinking. But, you know, I got up this morning and it's, you know, pretty much a done deal.
Yeah, it seems that way.
With, you know, one or two, with one big thingy hanging out there, which would be the U.S. House.
Right.
To be, you know, pretty fair. A few states in the balance, but, you know, soon enough for us to start looking at the results, look at the exit poll. So I thought what we do today is, you know, just give a quick rundown of what the relevant results are, you know, talk a little bit about some of the internals and what we think is going on there. Talk a little bit, of course, about polling, you know, what it told us, what it didn't tell us, why, and almost impossible to avoid some degree of hot takeness here.
Yeah.
But, you know, try to let it all settle before we get to, you know, we'll be talking about this a lot more.
Yeah.
I think in the very near future. But try to, you know, get our heads around the first take stuff here without getting too far out on a limb. So basic situation, you know, I'll start with the national and hand some stuff over to you. I mean, if you're listening to this, you know, after a lot of talk about it being an enormously close election in the polling, the results were pretty apparent by midnight last night.
Yep.
As of now, with a few states still hanging out there, I believe Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, still too close for the networks to call, at least, you know, as I was sitting down to come out here. But Donald Trump had clearly won in the Electoral College. You know, the declared count, 277, 7 passed the 270 for Trump, 224 for Harris, with Trump having sort of dominated the South, won some of the big swing states, or, you know, that were a focus of so much attention.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania was called sort of late last night, maybe in the wee hours of
the
morning.
North Carolina before that.
North Carolina before that. Pennsylvania, which everybody, you know, was sort of the linchpin.
Yeah.
At least, you know, going in, you know, went to Trump relatively early. Overall pattern, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, you know, looks like some underperformance in some of the major Rust Belt and Sun Belt major urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come around to that. In the U.S. Senate overall, nationally, Republicans, as widely anticipated, look like they are going to take the Senate. So the Senate will, quote unquote, flip. Again, Arizona, Nevada Senate races not called yet, but it's already as of now looking like, you know, that the Republicans will have at least 52 in the Senate, maybe as much as 54 with a few races still out there. And then in Texas, with about 99% of the ballots counted as of just a little while ago, it was 98 when I first put these notes together. Trump at 56.3 in Texas. Harris at 42.4, Jill Stein 0.7, Chase Oliver, the Libertarian 0.6, Donald Trump 6,367,000 votes, odd votes, Harris 4,794,474,000 votes, Stein a little over 80, Oliver almost 70,000. In the Senate race, Ted Cruz 53.2%. Just under 6 million votes, 5.965. Allred, 4.99 at 44.5%. So Cruz runs behind Trump. Allred runs ahead of Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ted Brown, the Libertarian, interestingly, I think, you know, 2.4.
Yeah.
Maybe a little higher than I might have thought. We'll unpack that, but not crazily. 265,600 odd votes.
You know, it's one of those things where, in the end of the day, it's sort of interesting as an aside, but it's also like 265,000 votes is a lot of votes if you think about how close some of the states, you know,
it's not nothing.
You know, it's
didn't, you know, not like it
matters.
You know, would have cost, you know, right, you know, right. somehow drastically hurt Ted Cruz. So, you know, the margins in those races, you know, we've talked a lot about the margins in top of the ballot races in Texas to the presidential level, mm-hmm. just under 14 points mm-hmm. in the Cruz all red race, you know,
just under nine,
you know, so between 8 and 9, well, can kind of come back to that. And then in the legislature, very, you know, looks like a net 2-seat gain for Republicans. Mm-hmm. Texas House should be 88 Republicans, 62 Democrat. You know, two flips that were widely anticipated, both from being a Democratic seat to a Republican seat. HD 54, the seat vacated by Abel Herrero that was redrawn in the last redistricting.
Is that 34 or 54? I think it's 34.
Oh, 34. Right. Yeah, it's a typo. Sorry. Yeah, 34. And then HD 80 vacated by Tracy King, who had run unopposed for much of his career.
Yeah.
A district long expected to turn whenever State Representative King decided to retire. That also goes to the Republicans. Net 1-seat gain in the Texas Senate. Morgan LaMantilla spent a lot of money but lost that race in a rematch. Senate will be 30 Republicans and 11 Democrats.
Yeah, and that race, about 2,800 votes was what separated that Senate seat.
Right, which, you know, close, but not as close as when she won.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly yeah. right.
So, interesting in that sense. So, you know, what it looked like in Texas. Josh, you know, talk about the votes, the shift in voter groups that we saw that was much discussed going into this.
Yeah, I'm sort of trying to figure out a way to like settle this in a some sense. And I mean, the first thing is just to start at the top just for a second and point out that, you know, with Donald Trump getting 6.3 million votes, that was a ton of votes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the questions going into this election in a lot of ways was, you know, whether there was a ceiling for Republicans in Texas, whether, you know, they'd been relying too much on the same groups of voters to turn out perpetually to sort of, you know, seed them each cycle. And what's interesting, it relates to this sort of shifting underlying dynamics thing, is that clearly Republicans found a lot of votes, right? And if
right.
you just look, for example, you know, Trump increased his vote totals over 2020 by about 630,000. I mean, it's a, you know, a pretty humongous increase, you know, and I think on the flip side, and we'll come back to this in some ways, you know, Harris underperformed Biden in 2020. So while Trump, again, added a huge number of votes, Harris actually lost about 450,000 votes. And if you take about, you know, the number of votes that Trump gained over his last performance, the number of votes that Harris lost over her last performance, what the difference was last time, you get to the gap, which is about 1.5 million votes, which is what ultimately the gap is, right? So it's
right.
the combination of those three things. The gap they started with, the additional votes that Trump got, and then the votes that Harris, you know, failed to get. You know, starting at a high level, and we can kind of jump in, I think, wherever you want about subgroups. I mean, one of the notable things that I kind of would sort yeah. of take away from this, you know, and this is looking at a mixture of, you know, exit polling over the last three presidential cycles, our own polling, just kind of what data is available with respect to the different groups in the electorate. And one of the things that I kind of notice is that, you know, especially in this election, is that, you know, when you think about the groups that we think of as, you know, quote unquote, Democratic groups, you know, you see Democrats sort of barely winning with a lot of these groups, if
yeah.
at all, right? If not breaking even. You know, when we think about, you know, women being a Democratic group, well, yeah, they're slightly Democratic, right? 18 to 29-year-olds, which again, in the exit polling split between Trump and Harris and went slightly for Allred over Cruz going to the exit polling. But again, slightly. It's a group that,
right.
you know, is slightly Democratic.
Thinking about the narratives going into this that
yeah.
was all about, you know, I mean, mobilizing women and, you know, and Democrats having building on an existing advantage and expanding it, that did not materialize
right.
near
college
as I can
educated
tell.
Voters, same thing. Slightly Democratic group, not overwhelming. Well, at the same time, they're losing badly with men, losing badly with white voters, and losing badly with non-college educated voters. And you can kind of cut these data in different sorts of ways, but that was one of the things sort of at the outset that I noticed is just, you know, to the extent that you think about the groups that Democrats are supposed to do well, you know, quote unquote, supposed to do well with, or they're supposed to rely on, you know, they're just not doing well enough. And to some extent, that was this election. But I mean, if you look back over the past elections, that also is part of the story, too, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Do you want to talk about some specific groups here? I mean, there's...
Yeah. I think talk about a couple of the specific numbers near as we can tell. And I think we should start by saying, look, we, you know, realize the exit polls are what they are. It is an imperfect measure. They have their own margins of error and there's a certain, you know, especially when the exit polls are out this fast, certain amount of ambiguity in here. But nonetheless, they're what you got.
Yeah.
And they're not... I have faith they're not 25 points wrong.
Yeah, I would say as a professional, my take of this is like, I'm not going to go out and quote these numbers as gospel, but if the estimates that we saw and the estimates that, you know, the exit polling is showing are basically, you know, a group that's within a couple points of itself, whether in the Harris direction, the Trump direction, or that's basically, that's a group that the parties are competing over, right?
Yeah.
If you see a group that's going 60, 70, 80, 90 points for one party or the other, I think it's safe to say that's a group that's leaning towards that party, at least in this election. And I think we can, you know.
Right.
I mean, there's a little bit more caveat than we need to do about small groups, you know, and you definitely see that in the exit polling when you start talking about, like, you know, non-college educated Asians, you know, whatever.
Yeah, point we've made before, the very tiny slices of the groups that are pulled out in the exit polls.
But nonetheless, there's something to be learned here. And I mean, I think a couple groups that really stand out. I mean, young people really stand out. You know, if you look at exit polling back in, you know, 2016, it was 55-36, you know, D to R, 57-40 in 2020. You know, and then looking at the exit polling today, they said 49-49, if not 51-47. Now, I think one thing about this group, this 18 to 29 group, I was talking to somebody about this before jumping on here, is, you know, one, look, it's clear that the trend there is pretty clear in terms of what we saw throughout the year, which is, you know, Democrats were not performing very well with young people, whether that was a Biden thing, a Trump thing, a Harris thing, some combination of all of those. I think actually is in and of itself unknowable, but part of the story. But we need to ask ourselves whether we shouldn't expect a lot of variance in their political preferences throughout the year up until the end, which is, I think, kind of what I saw in the polling throughout, is that, you know, those young numbers were bouncing around a lot throughout the year. We said, well, yeah, you had a, you know, a geriatric candidate who essentially, you know, performed himself off the stage. You have assassination attempts. You have replacements with very different candidates. And I would say notably, and I really hadn't thought about this morning, probably the most concerted focus on this group, and especially men within this group, of either party, of either major presidential candidate in any presidential election cycle that I can remember going back for quite a while, and especially in the last few weeks. To think that that doesn't have some kind of an impact, especially, and you can read our other stuff, absent sort of the clear moorings of like ideology and partisanship saying, you know, this is what a Republican is, this is what a Democrat is. I mean, like, so I think, you know, one, there's two things I take from that is, one, it's sort of, it makes sense why that group showed so much variance. It makes sense in some ways why Democrats, you know, may not have performed as well as they expected to perform with them. But again, and this is something we'll maybe come back to a couple times, we need to wait and see how durable, you know, what
some
we're seeing in this election.
And whether they are
a reflection of the moment or whether they are a reflection of more durable changes. The word realignments get thrown around a lot by people. Right now in the face of this election. And, you know, we can come back to that, but I think that's a caution, wait and see.
Well, we also have to remember that when we compare 18 to 20, you know, this, and age is tricky this way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, especially when you're at the bottom of the distribution or the brackets, you have to, you know, the 18 to 29 year olds we were talking to in 2016 are not the same 18 to 29 year olds that you're talking to in October of 2024.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You know, so there's something about the integrity of the way we think of that category.
Yeah, there's
that's a little too fixed, I think, a lot of the time, and doesn't, you know, account for the fact some significant share of those 18 to 29 year olds are now in the 30 to 44 year old category 6 years later.
Yeah, and I think a broader comment, you know, looking at this arc again over a couple election cycles, and using the data we have at our disposal right now, is that, like, you know, when you look in the younger cohorts, you know, if I were to characterize, you know, the way that we characterize these different age cohorts, 18 to 29, 30 to 44, 45 to 64, 65 plus, which is, you know, somewhat arbitrary, but also sensible. You know, what I would say, the way I would characterize it generally is, you know, the 65 plus cohort, which has been Republican, is looking a little bit less Republican. You know, the 18 to 29 cohort, which has been pretty reliably Democrat, is looking a little bit less Democratic. The flip side of that is that, you know, the 30 to 44 cohort, to the end, again, people are moving,
right,
is starting to look a little bit more Republican, right? And the 45 to 64 is just kind of sitting in there as you'd expect them to in some ways, because they're the most, in some ways, fixed in the electorate at this point. I mean, overall, there are some questions going forward. If those patterns hold, you know, it does speak to, you know, a couple of the Democratic, you know, regular talking points about the nature of the state. As young people mature, as the state becomes, you know, less white, all these things that are going to lead the... But, I mean, if you look at these numbers, you'd say, well, you know, I need a little more data, but, like, that's not what the numbers are necessarily showing at this
right.
moment.
I mean, in terms of the demographic thing, I also, you know, I'm noted, you know, you and I went to a seminar that featured our friend Lloyd Potter mm-hmm. doing the demographic deal, Lloyd being the director of the Texas Demographic Center, that showed that after years of steep inclines in that youngest mm-hmm. cohort, it's leveling off a bit.
Yeah.
Right. And so the nature of this is also getting a little bit different and should be expected to continue to get more different. You know, I mean, I think the other thing I would add about that, you know, in terms of that cohort moving around and what we know about or what, you know, and I think it held what we know about the, you know, the issue array that we've talked about a lot in this yeah. election. I don't know that we need to come back and talk about that, too, is the degree to which the economic concerns of this generation, I mean, you were talking about prices and mm-hmm. housing and stuff as we were talking before the podcast. You know, the other piece that I've made the point, you know, repeatedly on, as have a lot of people, but that I think is important, is that the experience of the economic dislocations after COVID, specifically rising prices mm-hmm. and the persistence of those high prices post-inflation, mm-hmm. which is an important distinction to make that certainly got munched, sometimes purposefully, in the campaign, have a lot of impact on young people.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't, and it's a very novel negative experience for
yeah.
not just that, but really for that 18 to 44 bracket.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're doing the math, you know, unless you're over the age of 60, there's almost no chance you were like balancing a checkbook circa 1979.
Right.
I mean, so like this is a new experience for people. And I would also say, you know, even setting aside, you know, even skipping over COVID, you know, you look at that 30 to 44 cohort, they were dealing with the effects of the housing collapse, right? And so to the extent that, like, you know, the structure of, you know, economics in the United States and sort of the expectations around, you know, quote unquote, the good life have impacted certain cohorts differently. Like, these are the cohorts that are probably
right.
most ripe for, you know, I think a lot of ways, more disruptive messaging about, you know, kind of the way things are going.
Well, or even, you know, I mean, disruptive. Yeah,
I mean, that's just a general
but also, you know, frankly, you know, a kind of manufactured nostalgia for how much better it was during, you know, pick your past time.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, I certainly, yeah, the pernicious effects of nostalgia are hard to underestimate often. And I think that's probably right.
And nostalgia is maybe too broad, you know, but I mean, just a simple, like, remember how much greater it was before COVID.
Yeah. Well,
economically, right?
And I think, yeah, there's been a lot of data, not our data, but I mean, just data nationally about sort of these cohorts kind of moving away from the idea of like home ownership. I mean, there's even a more general nostalgia about, like, you know, I think reckoning or reconciling, you know, what the current economic environment, and that includes not just high prices, it also includes, you know, student loan debt, it includes, you know, the cost of housing, it includes
yeah.
all these day-to-day things that are more than just about groceries, and the extent to which that has, like, fundamentally impacted people, you know, especially young people's perceptions of what the good life looks like or can look like.
And what, you know, what their prospects are.
Exactly.
You think about, do you expect to be better off a year from now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's hard, you know, and again, that's a tougher question yeah. to answer. And since COVID, honestly, in Texas, like, you see a lot of negativity towards all those kinds of perceptual questions. I mean, obviously, it'll be very interesting to see Trump's going to assume the White House, you know, how those national economic numbers all of a sudden flip. But one of the things that we've talked about repeatedly here is that, you know, especially at the state level, at the personal level, negative economic attitudes have been widespread. They've been, you know, everywhere. And it's not clear to me that, you know, Donald Trump taking over the White House and this is going to fix, you know, Republicans' feelings about their own personal economic prospects in this country immediately. We'll see. It'll be interesting sort of to be
TBD.
Well,
you know, I mean, it'll, you know, if the past is precedent,
yeah.
it will change
the
their
national.
Estimations of the macro economy more strongly and we'll see what it does with
yeah,
their personal.
Exactly.
Now, you know, you see traces of partisanship when we look at the personal, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just not as strong as when you ask people, what about the state economy? What about the national
well,
economy?
Well, and some of that's probably going to come down to coalitional elements, which,
yeah.
you know, again, and we can get into some of the other groups here that are key. So, I mean, it'd be silly not to talk about Hispanics,
yeah.
right, as a big part of this. you know, they are sort of the white whale of all the political parties here in Texas, right? A growing group, fought over. And, you know, honestly, according to exit polls, Republican leaning in this election cycle. So, you know, according to, again, the exit point available day after the election, caveats aside, Hispanics split 55-44 for Trump, 52-46 for Cruz. Again, is this exactly right? I don't know. I think it really lays out this general point, though, of competitiveness. And it's something that we had seen throughout the year and that really didn't dissipate at any point.
Right. And we had, you know, we had been seeing that in polling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll get to the polling a little bit more later. But I, you know, that turned out to be the dog that did bark this time.
Yeah, it did. I mean,
by all indications at this point. Yeah.
Just to set it aside real quick so we can just stay back on Hispanics, like African-Americans, a lot of talk about African-Americans. Ultimately, their vote distribution looks pretty much like their vote distribution looked like in most of the other elections that we've seen, you know, at least in the exit polling. You know, we'll see what the final data looks like, but that group doesn't seem to have like shifted dramatically towards Trump. But
yeah, a few point shift among men, mm-hmm. less so among women, and maybe even counterbalanced by women to some degree, but I don't remember.
I've
got to go back and look at that. And again, those numbers are so small. You know, before we do go I do want to sort of transition and talk about the polling a little bit, but let's talk a little bit also about the urban areas and where the voters are.
Yeah, this was the
The breakdown you did on the urban counties, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, this was, I mean, in some ways, you know, I went to sleep relatively early last night. And part of the reason I went to sleep relatively early is because when we were looking at, you know, when the national coverage was focusing on Nevada and Pennsylvania, I mean, the story that was starting to emerge was one of Trump performing slightly better, improving his margins just a little bit in a lot of the rural counties where there were fewer voters, but doing so consistently.
Yeah. And in some of the suburban, well, a lot of the
suburban. And in some of the suburban counties. And the flip side of that was, Democrats did not seem to be showing up in the numbers that would be required in the urban areas to offset that. Ultimately, that story that I think applied to North Carolina and Pennsylvania based on what we were seeing last night, I think that applied a lot here too. Now, we're going to need to get some more data. And I mean, we have a lot of counties in Texas, so it's going to take a little bit of time to get, you know, the final sets of data to look at this. But we can look at the big counties. And people were noting early in the night that, you know, turnout did not seem to be as high in some of the major counties, but also the vote margins there were nowhere near what they needed to be.
And that was something else true nationally.
For Democrats to compete, right? So just to give a couple examples of this, and we've talked about this a little bit, I won't go back through the whole history, but you know, if you look at, I'll say this first, Travis County was the one outlier here, and it still wasn't great for Democrats.
Right.
Democrats won Travis County in 2016 by 181,000 votes, by 274,000 votes in 2020, but then only by 227,000, according to data that we have today, in 2024.
Right. So it's an outlier, but only in extent.
Yeah, so 50,000 less, but still more than 2016. Now, the issue is every other major county here, Democrats did worse in 2024 than they did in 2016 in their vote margins. Harris County, Democrats won by 162,000 in 2016, 217,000 in 2020, 79,000 in this election. Bear County, they won by 80,000 in 2016, 140,000 in 2020, 72,000 in 2024. Dallas won by 198,000 in 2016, 291,000 in 2020, back down to 181,000. Tarrant, the swing county that it has been, which Democrats had won by a couple thousand votes in each of the last two presidential election cycles, they lost by 43,000 votes. I mean, you know, Democrats can't even come close to competitiveness here unless they're really running up the numbers in these urban counties. And to say real quick, you know, this isn't, you know, one point on a line doesn't make a trend, so we don't know how this goes going forward. But this was one of the big questions going into this election was, you know, does the line keep going up in terms of the Democratic margins? Does it level off? I don't think it was expected or likely that it was going to drop off like this. And the fact that I
just think about it the other way around. I'm just reversing the.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. I see what you're saying.
I've
been thinking about it as the gap declining, and then now it's. But anyway, same point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it would be surprising if anyone before the race were going to say, yeah, the Democrats are going to go from winning by, you know, somewhere on average of 200,000 votes in Harris County to, you know, about 80,000 like that.
Well, and it raises one of the puzzles of this, not puzzles, but, you know, one of the things that I think people, you know, are right to wonder about, which is that, you know, at the end of the summer, the narrative was something like Democrats might have dodged a bullet mm-hmm. by ditching Biden, replacing him with Harris, based on how we saw those Democratic numbers, like Harris's favorability, yeah, the gap in the trial ballots,
the movement among key groups.
You know, some of the movement among key groups get, you know, close up to, it was looking a little bit more in the vicinity of that line we're talking about.
Yeah.
The line being what the gap is at the top of the ballot.
Right.
But in the end, that does seem to have opened back up again at some point. And I guess the question for me is a little bit, what point? And, you know, because we're trying to compare what the votes are to what the trends in the polling. Let's talk a little bit about the polling.
Okay.
So overall, you know, as you pointed out, the increase in Republican votes came among a real decrease in Democratic votes at the top of the ticket and really up and down the ballot. And that was way beyond what was evident in most of the polling.
Yeah. I mean,
you're looking at about, you know, based on the numbers you kind of gave us at the beginning, you know, if you've got about, you know, a 450,000 vote decrease in the Harris share, or is that the, or no, increase in Trump's share. And then a little more than that, no, $450,000 drop in the Harris, the Democratic share compared to 2020.
Right, 450,000.
And then Trump increases the his vote total from 2020 by about 600.
Yep, about 500,
You know, you're looking at about $1 million votes, about $1 million vote swing.
And he already had about $500,000 vote cushion, which is why he gets to about 1.5 million.
Right.
Right.
So the math, yeah, the math adds up. But I mean, in terms of thinking about the polling, I mean, that's a pretty striking swing for one cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, the thing, again, is someone who's watching, I don't think that, I mean, in some ways, the turnout was a little bit underwhelming on its total, right? We saw about 11.3 million votes right now. There's 11.3 million votes in 2020, even though the denominator has gotten bigger. So we've added more registered voters. Having said that, we can set this aside and come back to it another day, another time. I mean, 2020 was a very unusual election.
Right.
And I think in Texas in particular, Texas is a low turnout state. That was an election in which Texas essentially said to its, I mean, essentially allowed its counties to try to maximize safe turnout, and it worked.
Yeah.
And now we're in a much different regime right now. I think, you know, you have to acknowledge that when comparing 2024 and 2020, they are not the same elections. The state had very different election rules.
Right.
So I think that's first and foremost, right? Nonetheless, you know, you see 61% turnout, you know, it's kind of around where it was. But I do think what is really surprising here is, you know, Republican turnout efforts worked. I mean, I think, you know, someone, you know, we can kind of sit aside and so we can look at the polling, we can look at the numbers, and we can look at kind of what we know. And I think having been here in Texas, you know, Republican efforts to find, register, and mobilize Republican voters have not been, you know, without effect. And I mean, they talked about this at the national level too, you know, kind of leading into the last few months of the election, that the Republicans had had a very unusual, in the sense historically, advantage in registrations. There had been more voters identifying as Republicans. There had been registering Republican voters all over the country where there's party registration. So you register and you declare a party when you register. And Republicans had been doing this all over. It actually sounds a lot like what Republicans have been doing in Texas, especially in the RGV and other areas, and trying to find Republican-leaning voters. And I think, you know, ultimately that helped. I mean, to the extent the Democrats kind of came late to the party, you know, in a bunch of ways, you know, they started registering more Democrats in the final, you know, 3 weeks of the election. You know, Texas, the idea, like, oh, you know, some people are saying, well, you know, Democrats threw $10 million in at the last minute. Why'd they do that? It's like, it's a drop in the bucket in a state like this. And honestly, it's about 3 years too late and about, you know, $90 million short. Right? Because ultimately, these efforts have been ongoing here. And I think if someone who watches, you can point to them all over the state where Republicans have been doing this. And it's hard to think of corollary efforts by the Democratic Party here.
Yeah, at least, you know, and I'm sure there are Democrats out there going, hey, look, there were groups doing this.
I'm sure there were.
The Beto group and all this. But it's just, you know, the extent and the effectiveness of the operation is just...
It's striking. I mean,
of the Republican operation is striking, and compared to, you know, what the Democrats did and had to had available to throw at it.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, I'm noticing some extent of criticism towards All Red's campaign or candidacy at this point, as is to be expected. You know, this is just what happens. But, you know, it's notable here, and I mean, this is also a little shout out to MJ Hagar, that essentially the 2024 Senate results were exactly the same as the 2020 Senate results. You know, and I mean, it might surprise some people here, but really, you know, they almost identical. I mean, within, you know, maybe 100,000 votes here or there, you know, so, and ultimately Allred, you know, added about 1 million votes to O'Rourke's totals. But Cruz added about 1.7 million votes to his own totals in 2018, right?
Right.
Cruz is sort of sitting there in the pack. We can kind of come back to the Cruz, you know, all red piece of this. But for Donald Trump to get to, you know, 6.3 million votes to add about 500,000 votes to his 2020 totals is really a remarkable feat. And I think it is something that would be hard for, I mean, just to be honest, it would be hard for point on cover. I think, you know, and part of it is maybe pollsters were looking in the wrong direction, I think. You know, to the extent that the polls were showing, all the polls were consistently showing Republican victories here. I mean, just to set aside, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's talking about herding and all these other things. But if all the polls are pointing in one direction, they're all also pointing in the same direction. There are very few polls, if any, that showed Harris leading at any point. There's one that maybe showed Allred leading at one point by a point within the margin of error. And when people would say to me, well, you know, if what are you, you know, as a poll?
And we should stop and, you know, pause for and just point out, that's to be expected.
Yeah. That's to be expected.
Right. It's actually more, would have been more worrisome to not have at least a couple of outliers. Like
yeah. No, I mean, and I think the smart.
Nonetheless, the preponderance of the polling showed that, you know, at no point did either Allred or Harris have anything resembling an advantage in Texas the polling.
And that's right. And the smart criticism around the herding is to say you should see some more actually results on the other side of the zero line, right? I mean, but that's a different story. We'll talk about that, you know, another time.
Yeah.
But as pollsters, I think, you know, if someone was saying to me, well, what are you, to the extent that these results might be way off, you know, what are you worried about? Honestly, I was worried about the opposite, which is, you know, what if a bunch of young women spurred on by, you know, Democratic mobilization, Roe v. Wade, you know, Trump's comments, Cruz's unwillingness to address the issue, turn out at rates that we just couldn't foresee, right?
Yeah.
You know, what would that look like? You know, how would we account for that? And the answer is, well, we can't account for it. We really can't. I think, you know, we're seeing this in a similar way, but in a different way, which is to the extent that Trump was able to improve his margins amongst Hispanics who are probably less likely to vote, again, non-college educated voters, as always, he's a turnout machine.
You know, ironically, a lot of low propensity voters.
Yeah, lower. I mean, this
that are usually thought of as the object of Democratic efforts.
Exactly.
And a potential source of Democratic votes.
Yeah. And a big, you know, and a big sort of, you know, way station on the way to Democrats, you know, sadness last night was this idea. Well, you know, Democrats are doing better with older voters, which is strange, but also they're more likely to vote. So therefore, you know, now nobody ever attached a number to it and said, you know, what
right.
this looks like. And ultimately, like a lot of these things, it's probably still a very Republican leaning group overall. And so you're just, again, you're fixing your margins. But again, it's a group that Republicans are winning, you know, 60 points, 70 points, whatever. So yeah, you knock off a couple points. That's great. But it's not going to make this huge difference in the way that it seems like, you know, Trump's ability to, again, turn out lower propensity voters from a bunch of different groups. And I think that's the key here. And that's another thing I want to sort of say as sort of a, you know, it's like a classic theme of this podcast. You know, my view of this is that, and we've talked about this all along, is this election has been about, you know, margins of margins. It's been about, you know, making fine efforts into cutting away the advantage among certain groups. And it's not surprising that all the dominoes kind of fell the same way, you know, because, and I think that's because, to me, and that's just because ultimately the driving issue in this election was the economy. You know, there's a Democrat in the White House who are unhappy with the direction of the country. It'd be very unusual for these groups to have these, you know, to split in all different directions across these issues. But what it also means when you're talking about, you know, if Trump got 12% of African Americans versus 10 or 11 versus 10 or slightly more men, you know, Latino men or whatever, ultimately what it means is that it's the combination of all of these things. But I think what you're going to hear in the next few days is like, well, you know what happened? It was this.
Yeah.
It was Latino men or it was, you know, college-educated white men, I'm just gonna say right now, there's no data or no amount of data that is going to allow us to really say like this was the arrow, this is the causal story.
Yeah.
When it's a lot of things, right?
And there's also I think there's a desire on some people's part to, you know, be the first to declare a realignment.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God!
And you know, it's a little. I mean, you know, there are movements going on here, but I think I agree that there's not definitive.
Is it?
You know, not much in the way of definitive.
Is it fair to briefly define what that word means here? I mean,
sure.
just real quick. I mean, when I think of a realignment, what we talk about is a durable change in the underlying coalitions that make up the party system. So the groups that support, you know, one candidate, you know, one set of candidates or another from each party. And the idea and the key here is, number one, it's durable, right? So one thing is we can't declare a realignment after a single election. We have to see how durable this is. I mean, honestly, we're going to have a big test of this in 2 years, how durable, you know, this coalition is. Also, I'm a little reluctant to say it's a realignment because you're not saying, well, you know, Hispanics now are a Republican group. Well, I don't think that there's any data that would at this point say with definitiveness that, like, yes, Hispanics are now a Republican group. They were a Democratic group, but now they're, you know, solidly in the Republican coalition. Trump's victory, again, was based on doing better among lots of groups. That
yeah,
doesn't
but,
necessarily
and that's not to downplay, you know, the extent to which there was a flip here. I mean,
no, not at all. I mean,
I mean, if you look at the 2020 exit polling, you know, that had. But although, you know, it feels like not very many people looked at this exit polling going into the election. I mean, we kept
the
making that point
remarkable.
Here. You know, Democrats won Hispanic, according to the 2020 exit polls, 58-41. This time, the exit polls at the presidential level. This time, the exit polls have Republicans winning 55-44.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's, you know, that's real. But to your question, you know, is it durable?
Is it durable?
And that number is not, that is not what the national numbers look like. So
right.
That's another thing to note here. The national numbers moved more in a Republican direction, but not as much as we saw in Texas, which, you know, does lead to questions of, you know, what is distinctive about Hispanics in Texas, et cetera, which is probably a topic for another day. You know, I mean, you know, I'm interested in kind of the, you know, the trajectory of the polling and in Texas and what we make of that, because there is a narrative we talked about a little bit going in, not setting aside at all or notwithstanding at all the unknowables that we're talking about in terms of the magnitude of the Republican mobilization, the degree to which that did or did not show up in polling, how it might have been caught. But, you know, the moving averages, if you go back and look, did show the race opening up, the gaps opening up a little bit. Right? If you go back and you look at the aggregate, you know, the various aggregators, as we've said in here, who, you know, weight their aggregations different in their own aggregator way. But they were remarkably similar. You know, the average in, you know, the poll averages in the two or three main aggregators in the presidential race in Texas was about 8 points.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate was about four
on
the eve of the election. And so these slight shifts did converge, you know, in conjunction with the mobilization effort. You know, also in conjunction with, you know, I think you have to see is the collapse of any Democratic efforts at the state level to mobilize the base.
Failure,
you know,
is a fair
produce
word
this.
Here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how you look at the Democratic vote totals and look at a drop of, you know, more than 400, a decrease of more than 400,000 votes from the previous election and not say that something was not done right.
Yeah, and had you hit that target, you still would have lost by over a million votes.
Right. You know, I guess I would ask you this. I mean, I would ask you this as a surrogate for, you know, 800 reporters or at least a few, which is, you know, what could have been done differently here? There's going to be a bunch of, you know, reverse engineering and
polling.
Yeah.
It's tough. You know, I mean, I think this is the nature, you know, I hate to say this, but in some ways, you know, this is partially the nature of when Trump's on the ballot. I mean, I think pollsters have demonstrated a real difficulty reaching all of the electorate that Trump seems to be able to mobilize in a given election. I don't think that it's necessarily like, you know, I think, you know, it's not for lack of effort. It's not for lack of trying. It's not for making adjustments. You know, our screen on this poll to choose, it was very, I was gonna say liberal, but that's not the right word. I'm gonna use loose.
Generous.
It was very generous, right? In terms of allowing people to come in. I mean, I don't think there were a lot of low propensity voters who indicated to us that they had a desire to participate that didn't make their way into the poll. You know, I think what's tough for me about this, just thinking about going forward, is, you know, and this doesn't really speak to polling, maybe it just speaks to general things, is, you know, we talk about a lot, you and I talk a lot about the changes in sort of the media environment, you know, and the extent to which the narratives that people are telling themselves, you know, about the election are increasingly insular.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, if you talk to anybody, I mean, you know, we talk to a lot of people who I think we would classify broadly as, you know, quote unquote elites, you know, participants, whatever, and on both sides. And that's the thing, you know, and when you talk to these people, you know, you get really different stories.
Yeah.
And these are, I think these aren't the on TV, you know, this is what I'm going to say. I mean, a lot of these are, you know, these are real stories with people, you know, who are kind of telling you what they hear, what they're thinking. And, you know, the stories are just very, very different. And I think the stories are very different because the stories people are hearing are very different. And so there's no like one election narrative, you know, anymore. I mean, you know, if you think about the final weeks of the campaign and you know, the level of chaos in some ways that came out of the Trump campaign, you know, different election cycles, obviously people are like, oh, that would have been the end. You know, that would have been it. You know, well, yeah. And the people who felt that way got a lot of that messaging, and the people who didn't, right? So there's that. I mean, one of the other things that I've been thinking about a lot for Texas here is, I mean, man, we got about 9 million of these 11.3 million votes early.
Yeah.
I mean, now that's we've been seeing that. We've been seeing it.
Yeah, we've
been seeing this, but not to that extent. That's higher than what I think we've seen in the past.
Yeah, Election Day turnout, I think, was not great.
Yeah, and so one of the things you wonder is, you know, how does this change, you know, both the election calendar? I mean, one of the things that luckily we do is, you know, we're out of the field before early voting begins. I mean, we were done interviewing October 10th. So we were done interviewing, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks before early voting even begins. Yeah. And so out of the field, you know, And so, you know, I think it is something to think about for pollsters too. And it's really hard once you start pulling during the election. It's like, well, who's voted? Who hasn't voted? What does that look like? But what's clear is like, I mean, the turnout operations, and especially on the Republican side, but also on the Democratic side, are really geared towards this identifying and mobilization over this period of time. And I think that, you know, if you think about what impact that has on low propensity voters, you know, you don't need to show up at a certain place on a certain day to wait in line for some indeterminate amount of time. You know, we just got to get you to one of the countywide voting locations in this 2 week window. And I think, you know, Republicans have obviously embraced this in a way. It used to be, oh, Republicans love Election Day voting. And it's like, yeah, I think, you know, Republicans just want to get their voters out, and they're doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, none of this is really speaking to what I would do.
You know, there was some short term noise in that I think, well, you know, what I would take at that point is that the short term noise caused by the combination of COVID, the pushback against COVID, you know, relaxation of expansion of voting rules, and then the mixed messaging from Donald Trump in that immediate aftermath, they overcame that.
Yeah.
Republicans overcame that.
And I would say, you know, I mean, the broader sort of picture to me is, I mean, one of the things that I sort of, you know, again, we're sort of in the hot take-y, better than cold take, but like, you know, I mean, one of the things I think Trump realized in this cycle, or his people realized, or they realized in journalism, is like, you know, he wasn't going to lose Republican voters. You know, and we've been talking about this for years now. You know, there's no indication in the polling that there were a lot of never Trump Republicans. There's no indication in the polling that there was a large potential for crossover voting, for people leaving their ballots blank. You know, Trump was very well liked by Republican voters here in Texas. And in some ways, you know, with the last, you know, the period of him out of office, I think proved in some ways was, you know, there was little that he could do or say that was going to actually alienate his base voters. And what that really freed him up to do, I think, in a way that is really unique, is that it freed him up to seek out those voters who aren't part of his coalition. Well, he really got to spend time focused on those voters, whereas I think, you know, the Democrats, for all their, you know, they're mostly on defense. They're mostly trying not to lose voters. I mean, to the extent that Harris entered the race, we asked this question at that time. Okay, she seems to be back where she should be with these voters, which, again, in Texas still means you're losing.
Yeah.
And then the question was, could she do better or worse? And ultimately, the answer was it got worse.
Well, and I think, you know, you kind of think about the list of, you know, a couple of them are kind of embedded in your comments there. The list of things that people said publicly or said to themselves. On the Democratic side, that just turned out to not be the case.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, certainly this should put to rest, you know, the common thought, again, among people in certain social milieus that, you know, there was a non-trivial share of Republicans that would reject Trump and or reject Cruz.
Yeah, and they just pointed the numbers.
There's just not, I mean, if anything, it was more on the opposite side. There was more to, and it wasn't a lot, but there was, you know, the exits show more defection Democrats to Republicans, and particularly at the presidential level, than the other way around. Not less so in the Senate race, you know. But I think the other thing I was thinking about, and that I was going to raise, and it kind of is the flip side of what you were just saying, or part of what you were just saying, which is that, you know, I think Democrats reassured themselves by saying yes. On one hand, even if you said most Republicans and voters, in fact, do support Donald Trump.
Right.
But on the other hand, he seems to have a ceiling. His ceiling is 47%. And I think, you know, the Trump folks looked at that. The Trump campaign looked at that in the opposite way. They didn't say that's our ceiling. They said that's our base.
Yeah.
And they're secure. and let's see what we can do to add to it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and I, not to repeat what you said, but I mean, the point about, I mean, I'm thinking a lot today, this morning, about what people said to themselves about to get away from something else that everybody's talked about, that we talked about. Darren mentioned it, I think, right after the poll. We talked about it a little bit last week, to get away from the fact of, you know, look, if you really clear away all the underbrush, the fundamentals of this election put the Democrats at a real disadvantage. Right? You know, economic, you know, job, you know, Biden's job approval numbers, economic assessment numbers, right track, wrong. You know, everywhere you looked, the fundamentals suggested that this should have been a very clear Republican advantage. And this idea that only, you know, the only thing that was making it less so with Donald was Donald Trump himself.
Right.
Now, that may still be the case around the edges, but it was clearly not the case enough, not enough the case to have an impact.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a significant impact on the outcome.
I was having this, you know, text argument with a friend, you know, very, very highfalutin, you know, kind of left-leaning people. And I think, you know, for people on the left, the idea that this election was about Donald Trump and his fitness for office was almost, you know, taken as sort of just sacrosanct. It was without question that this is what the election is about. And I think, one, that's clearly was up to for debate, you know, at least in the data, because even when we asked Democratic voters their issues, you know, Trump came up, but there were other issues that came up, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I would say for the vast majority of, you know, I would say less ideologically attached voters, those, you know, again, Democrats who felt that way and Republicans who obviously had, you know, were going to support Trump no matter what, you know, as you point out, the economy was much more front and center. Maybe immigration and the border was more front and center, right? There are other...
Well, it was, you know, I mean, Trump's numbers on immigration and border security, I mean, he didn't turn Democrats in some huge numbers, but, you know, a non-trivial share of Democrats told us they trusted Trump more on the border than Harris.
And you even added, you know, sort of an outside issue like foreign policy, right? Which, again, and so there are a lot of ways, you know, I think... Again, if you step outside, you know, your own bubble, and this is why, you know, I mean, this is a plug for polling. I mean, you can say right now, you know, we're sitting here on the day after the election. Seems like the polls aren't taking too much of a beating, although I feel like I've personally taken
it. Look, let's just be straight about it. I mean, you know, we had Cruz beating up on All Red by 7. But, you know, I think again, this is in early October.
Right.
And at that point, we also had, Trump up on Biden by about 5.
Right.
And... But Cruz-Trump number wound up being pretty close. I think the fundamentals of that race
Cruz-Allred
didn't change very much. The Harris-Trump number, you know, the gap was bigger, you know, pretty substantially bigger. It wound up at, what, 13, almost 4, essentially, call it 14, right?
Right.
So, and I think that is that, you know, that underestimated Trump vote was just out there. And I do think a lot of people, Republicans did a good job of mobilizing a lot of voters that were low propensity voters in all likelihood.
And we'll see in the data.
You know, and that's what it looks like.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
And, there probably was something of a late break.
Yeah, and I also, but I mean, the point I was going to make about polling is, you know, I think absent polling, you know, we're really left to really just relying on our own social interactions, which, if you know, I think everybody should acknowledge are becoming increasingly insular. Because I said, you know, to the extent that I think a lot of Democrats were out there coming up with their rationales for why, you know, it was going to be a great night for Harris. You know, I mean, there was all, you know, again, hiding in plain sight. And part of the discussion throughout the whole year was, you know, okay, but like, is she going to get like 80 or 90% of African Americans? Okay, you know, what's her numbers going to be among Latinos in these key states? You know, in states, not just like Texas, but in states like Pennsylvania, right?
Is she going to get 60% of women?
Is she going to get 60% of women, right? You know, I mean, all these things were real questions out there. And, you know,
and how much is that going to cost her in men? I mean, I do think that discussion was
under
pretty salient, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it was coming up in the final, you know, some people were raising it. It really came up in the final days a lot more.
Yeah. But I mean, look, I mean, to the extent that, you know, she, underperformed, you know, relative to where we were more than, you know, the sort of Allred did in the Cruz-Allred race, you know, I'm just going to sit here and say, you know, it raises the question of her gender on the overall, you know, outcome of that race, and whether people were less inclined to be, some very small share of people were less inclined to be honest about, you know, what might be, you know, a vote based on less than pure, you know, reasoning, right? you know, whether misogyny, sexism, racism, whatever. You know, you can say, yeah, but Allred did. Yeah, I get it. But Allred played football at Baylor. Like, I mean, we'll come back around to that maybe at a different point in time. And I think, you know, it took until, I mean, for me personally, I've been saying this probably not on this podcast because I don't know exactly how to address it, and we're at the very end, so it feels like the right time to do it. But I mean, it's interesting listening to, you know, I said Claire McCaskill, and again, she has her own stake in all this, kind of raising the point. Once she sort of saw some data that clearly, you know, at which point she clearly became crestfallen last night, she basically said, you know, yeah, we're probably going to have to ask ourselves, you know, what replacing a white old guy from Scranton that people were generally comfortable with a black woman from California.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that overstates the degree, you know, there's a lot dwelling in that generally comfortable with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know. Well, that's why we're not, and that's, again, that's why we're going to save that for another day, more data, more, I need to see more information, but it is something that I think, you know, Democrats kind of glossed over, you know, I think in sort of thinking about strengths and weaknesses as the stretch, you know, in the home stretch of this race. And yeah, you know, it's easy to kick the team that lost and all that kind of stuff, right? You know, and it's easy to say what the winners did really well, but also, like, it's pretty apparent.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've got a pending press call that's asking, you know, ultimately, would Biden have done better in Texas? And I do not think so.
I don't think so either. And I think that's very, I want to be very clear about that. I'm not saying that Biden would have done better.
Or even nationally. I mean, I don't see it. I mean, I think...
Right. But I mean, there is something.
You're talking about a completely different race.
Yeah. And I also think, you know, you do wonder to yourself, you know, okay, would Harris have made it through the primary process as we have established right now? Well, ultimately, she didn't the first time. There's a lot of indications to think that she wouldn't have, you know, kind of on her own. The question is going to be going forward. Does she go, you know, through this again? But ultimately, you know, she wasn't able to manage that gauntlet. I'm not saying that that gauntlet of the primaries produces the best candidate, but to the extent that the candidate who was, just picking a word here, foisted, you know, upon people, didn't perform as well among some of those groups. Well, maybe there's some, I mean, again, I've been in here and I've said, maybe the process is stupid. Well, you know, maybe the process has some validity too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And look, I mean, you know, just not to miss something obvious.
Yeah.
You know, there was not a lot of time to prepare that candidacy and to execute it.
No, that's right.
And, you know, period.
Yeah.
Right. But I, you know, and again, I don't want to, I mean, I take your point. We've talked about it. I mean, you know, it would be kind of crazy, particularly given some of the cultural themes of the Trump campaign, to not say, you know, having a black woman at the top of the ballot had an impact.
Yeah. And it really
it was going to impact some voters in a, you know, in various kinds of ways, whether, you know, in helping to mobilize low propensity voters, you know, helping, you know, mobilize your base.
I mean, the main point is
in a campaign where the theme, if you, I don't know if you read the Tim Alberta piece on the internal conflict in the Trump campaign that came out in the Atlantic a few days ago, that absolutely, I think, among Democratic elites helped raise their hopes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a, you know, pretty clear split, at least per Alberta's narrative, between, you know, the professionals at the top of the Trump campaign who wanted to run, you know, the kind of campaign that we're talking about that basically said, talk about the economy, talk about Biden's failure, you know, talk about are you better off 4 years ago, don't talk about anything. And, you know, what the candidates' impulses were.
Right.
Right. And it does wind up entering into this, but, it, you know, he is going to certainly feel like the way that he did it was correct. And that will mean that these themes will continue to be, you know, hit on.
Yeah.
And, you know, that does feed back to the issue about, you know, what, you know, just the degree to which the identity of the Democratic candidate wound up being, you know, a factor here. I mean, I think you can't discount it. And I think, look, the campaign itself knew it. I think Kamala Harris herself was pretty aware of it in terms of the way that she campaigned and the way that she, you know, essentially, at least compared to what one might expect from previous Democratic campaigns, de-emphasized that element, you know, that element of the campaign.
And I think that's, you know, just to maybe finish out here and just to be, to be fair, you know, while the very nature of her candidacy likely activated, you know, some of these cleavages that Donald Trump has done, you know, a really, you know, active job of, you know, mobilizing and relying on throughout his time in office, right? And in some ways, you know, and she just does it just by her presence. I also want to be clear here, too, that, you know, look, as a female candidate, as a candidate of color, you know, she was walking a different, you know, set of rules than would another candidate, right?
Absolutely.
Outside of, you know, whatever, who she was running against, whatever. And so I just to be clear, you know, making that, you know, I'm putting in quote, you know, criticism in quotes. Yes, some of that had to do with the fact that, you know, just the nature of what happened, how it played out, the nature of Donald Trump's candidacy, but also there are just sort of cultural factors here that I think, you know, put her in a situation that, not put her in a situation, but, you know, leads to a situation in which she was going to be at a disadvantage regardless of who she ran against, unless it was another woman of color.
Right. It was bound to be helpful in some corners of mobilization. I mean, you know, like you look at the data we have on Republican voters' beliefs about what groups experience discrimination, et cetera. Those attitudes were still in play in a campaign. I can hear people like, I can imagine people listening going, well, you know, yeah, duh. I mean, look at some, you know, Trump's rhetoric, you know, what we know about his personal history, his views of race, et cetera. But they did a, you know, again, they did a pretty effective, a clearly effective job of isolating out small slices of the electorate, including among women and including among African-American voters, not a ton, but that, you know, that were open to the appeal.
Well, and it's interesting, too. I mean, to the extent that, you know, Harris really tried to assiduously avoid, you know, sort of placing herself in, you know, what people broadly call like identity politics and stuff. And she really avoided raising her gender, and she really avoided raising, you know, her race. And yet at the same time, you know, the, I think the promise of her candidacy amongst Democrats, you know, when it sort of first was presented was, you know, well, maybe this will reestablish sort of the Obama coalition, which in a lot of ways was like really a lot more overt about kind of acknowledging, you know, diversity, identity, all these pieces. And so it's interesting in some sense that, you know, they sort of so assiduously avoided that. And part of that may have just been, you know, a calculated gamble because, look, of the opponent.
Yeah. Some of it, you know, it's interesting. I think some of it was assiduously avoiding that. And some of it was, you know, an artifact of that moment.
Yeah.
Where the focal point that triggered all that was Biden's age.
Yeah.
Right. And that became the kind of master narrative.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at least the predominant theme of the narrative in that period when the decisions were made, the strategies were implemented to elevate her to the top of the ticket. So, and, you know, that is something that will, you know, be playing out for a while here. So I think with that, Josh, thanks for all the work and the thoughtfulness and the willingness to just do this right away.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Thanks for the trust.
Yeah, sure, of course. And well, you know, and so I will also say to our listeners, you know, we'll be back and we'll, there's a lot more to unpack here.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the data, whether it's, you know, I mean, we haven't talked at all about, you know, the issue ownership, the issue deployment, what played out. I mean, we haven't to some degree in talking about the economy and immigration, but we'll probably come back to that sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. Particularly since we just did a piece on the website that's on our website about immigration and border security and how that plays and its role and its the nature of those, the emphasis on those issues among Republican voters. So I would point you to that. Until then, thanks to Josh for being here. Thanks, as always, to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, who got us into this studio on short notice. Find a lot of the data we're talking about at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks to you, of course, for listening. Get some rest, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.